You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right. So, yes, my name is Kristen Meyer, and I'm going to be talking about holding the center in our family. So this is the idea of keeping God at the center of our family. I tried to pick a picture where all of my children are actually looking at the camera. That's hard to do. But this is my family. So my daughter, Lily, is going to be starting fourth grade this next year. My middle child, Levi, he's going to be in first grade. And then Asher is going to be a kindergartner. And so when I thought about this topic, this is something that I feel like I've had to come back to repeatedly in my time as a mom. And yes, like the things that we talk about here this morning might be things that you're like, yes, I know this, I've learned this before. But I think these are good reminders for us. We need to constantly go back and say, who's at the center of our family? Is it God or is it something else? So the first thing I want to talk about is that parenting is a sacred task. God has given you his children and he has made you their caretakers. He has entrusted you with something very special. Psalm 127 says, children are a heritage from the Lord, offspring a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are children born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. You know, what he's saying here is that children are a blessing. Like the children that God has given you are a reward from him. You should be thankful for what he's given you. But not just that, he's saying, you know, I have given you my child that I have made for a purpose, that I have specific tasks designated for, and it is your duty to raise them up and train them to be effective warriors for my spiritual battle. And so this is a big call and a big task that we have as parents. Proverbs 17:6 says, children's children are a crown to the age, and parents are the pride of their children. So yes, we are blessed as parents and one day grandparents by the children that we have. But not only that, if we have a biblical, healthy family relationship, relationship with our child, we are actually going to be a blessing to our children, where they're going to be proud. They're going to say, man, I am proud that Kristen is my mom or Kim is my mom, you know, whoever. Like, I am proud to have this parent. So why is childhood important in parenting? You know, yes, we are parents our whole life once we have children for the rest of our lives, but childhood and adolescence, those are the years that are really important in parenting. So I was reading this book, The Collapse of Parenting. This is by Dr. Leonard Sachs. He's written several books that I love, but in this book, he talks about why is childhood important. So when we talk about childhood, the definition that he uses is it's the interval between weaning and sexual maturity. Adolescence, the teenage years, this is defined as the time between the onset of sexual maturity, so when you can reproduce, have children, and being fully mature. So that's physical development as well as brain development. You know, for humans, like men, their brains aren't developed till the age of 25. So that's a long span of time. So he talks about how different species have different lengths of childhood and adolescence. Rabbits only spend 10% of their lives in childhood, and they don't even have an adolescence. Like, as soon as they are ready to reproduce, they are fully developed. Horses, they spend 10% in childhood, 4% in adolescence. So that's 14% of their lifespan is spent in childhood and adolescence. But humans, on the other hand, and he takes into account, you know, hunter-gatherer times, as well as now, what is the average lifespan of a human? And when you look at that, 15% of our lives are spent in childhood and 15 to 16% in adolescence. So why is that such a big span of time? What is the point? Why are humans so different from other animals? The answer is culture. When anthropologists use the term culture, they are referring to the collection of practices and customs which are characteristic of individuals in one community, but which are not shared by individuals of the same species who live in another community. They also mean that the differences between the two communities are not genetically programmed. Children and adolescents learn these customs and practices either by watching the adults or by receiving active instruction from the adults. So, culture. You know, American culture is very different than other countries. I was thinking about this. We just did a family trip to Costa Rica, and we took our kids. And at one point, you know, we go off the touristy path and we, you know, our very first night there, and we go to a restaurant where there's only locals. We are the only foreigners there. And we're trying to communicate with people and speak what very little Spanish we have using Google Translate and all of that fun stuff. But at one point, this woman comes up and, you know, is trying to interact with us. And she comes up to tell us that our children are beautiful. And the whole time, she's like right by my son and she's just rubbing his arms, you know, and then she's touching my husband's back, you know, just like very physically affectionate. And my son is just looking at her like, my God, what is this woman doing to me? Like, he actually looks appalled and is like pulling away from her. And then she's just laughing and doing it more. She's like, what's going on? So then we had to tell him, like, hey, and, you know, this culture, that, you know, that is being friendly and welcoming, so you're probably going to experience that while you're here. You're going to get hugs randomly. You're going to have physical contact, so get ready for it. You know, even in America, we have different cultures. You know, we go visit great-grandma Shirley. She lives in the Villages. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's wild, crazy retirement community in Florida, and it's like a county, you know, county big retirement community. There's like a million pools, golf courses, you know, all that. But when you go to the Villages, there's things that you need to understand to interact in the Villages. Like, for example, you need to understand golf cart etiquette because they are everywhere and there's special roads for golf carts. And you need to understand social etiquette too. Like, you can't just say thank you once when you're talking to someone. You need to thank them five times. You need to say it repeatedly or you're not actually thankful. Or you need to offer to pay the bill for the restaurant at least three times before you cave in. Like, there's just etiquette that you need to follow when you're in the Villages. And we have our own culture here. If someone says OH, you know what you're supposed to say, whether you like it or not. But there's culture everywhere. And the question is, who do you want to teach your children culture? Do you want it to be the shows that they're watching, the movies that they're watching, the music that they're listening to? Do you want it to be their friends or their friends' parents, their teachers? And so as parents, we need to decide, what culture do we want to instruct our children in? That is our task as parents. And then how are we going to communicate and teach that culture to them? And the Bible agrees with this. Proverbs 22:6 says, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he grows older, he will not abandon it. Like what we teach our children here and now is going to have lasting impact into adulthood for them. Deuteronomy 6 says, these words, which I am commanding you, this is God speaking, shall be on your heart. And you shall repeat them diligently to your sons and speak of them when you sit in your house, when you walk on the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. And what he's saying is, what should we be teaching our children? What's the culture we should be communicating? It's what God cares about. What has God commanded? What does he value? But he doesn't just say it to them once and they'll remember it. You know, just tell them one time and they'll know it for the rest of their life. No, he says this should be a part of everyday life that we're teaching. When we're walking down the road, when we're sitting in our house, you know, all of these day-to-day activities that we have, these times that we have with our kids, these are all teaching opportunities. So how are we teaching them the culture we want them to know? Ephesians 6:4 says, fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Don't sit there and frustrate your children trying to hammer in all these things that aren't valuable and aren't important, but rather, what does the Lord care about? And that's what we should be focused on. And finally, Proverbs 1:8-9. Listen, my son, to your father's instructions, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. They are a garland to grace your head and a chain to adorn your neck. When we focus on these things and we take the time to instruct our children in them, these are going to help them have a fruitful and productive life, a fulfilling life. It's going to impact their adulthood and the rest of their lives. So parenting is a sacred task. So I love listening to Howard Hendricks' teachings. If you know me, you know this about me. I listen to them when I run. He's one of my favorite teachers. But he has this interesting quote from his teaching on leadership for the family. And he says, you know, we have to have objectives as parents. If we want to teach culture, what is the culture we want to communicate? What is our objective? He says, your objectives determine your outcomes. You achieve that for which you aim. People start in a marriage and in a family with a lot of dreams and a lot of ideals, but oftentimes they have never spelled out their objectives. So So what is our objective in parenting? Well, my family, we've been doing daily, like, morning devotionals together, and this is one of the passages that we were reading a couple weeks ago, and I feel like this sums it up perfectly. What is the culture that we are trying to communicate to our children, the objective? Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Love him with all your mind. This is the first and most important commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Everything that is written in the law and the prophets is based on these two commandments. Anything you read in the Bible, this kind of sums it up. All the one another passages, all of the other commandments we read, it's all centered on this. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Howard Hendricks also summarizes the objectives or priorities in this way. He says, first of all, we need to focus on maintaining personal and spiritual integrity. Second, developing marital intimacy. You know, he makes the case in this teaching, he's like, unless you are spiritually intimate with God, you will not have marital intimacy. And then third, fulfilling parental responsibility. Mark the order. You have to ask yourself, what do I have to give my children? And if you don't have spiritual integrity and marital intimacy, he makes the case you don't have much to give them. So think about it like this. When we picture the family, kind of looks like this, this idea of the universe or the solar system. And God is the sun. He is the center, right? We are, as the parents, orbiting him. But he is at the center. Who is God? What does he care about? What does he value? What does he say in his Bible? What mission has he given us? Those things should be at the center. And us as the parents, the husband and the wife, you know, we are circling. We are orbiting God. So our day-to-day life should be focused on what does God say here? What has he commanded me to? What is his mission for us as a family and for me as a parent? And as we are orbiting God, then children, our kids, are like the moon there. Kids are focused on us. They are looking to us as their examples. You know, we are their authorities, and they are looking at how we act, how we behave, the choices that we make, and that helps them understand what God is like and what it looks like to follow him. And so as they're following us, they're still orbiting God. They are still following him. So it's easy to say that we believe something, right? Say, you know, yes, I believe this is true. I believe God should be at the center of my family. But do we actually live that out? In a separate teaching, because I like listening to his teachings, he says, a conviction is a principle that I cherish or prize highly enough that I practice it in my life. There is a vast difference between your belief system and your convictional system. Your belief system is something you will argue for. Your convictional system is something you will die for. Yes, I may believe that God should be the center of my family, but am I convicted of that? That no matter how inconvenient it is in my day-to-day life, God is still going to be center. What he has called me to is still going to be the first priority. No matter how sleep-deprived I am, no matter how painful it is in that moment, am I still committed to the mission that God has given me, first and foremost? And that's something we need to evaluate. I was thinking about this in a very hypothetical situation. My husband and I were having this random conversation that, yeah, it was not real. But he was basically like, oh, what if we were called to be missionaries? We are not called to be missionaries. But we were thinking about it. And he was like, you know, would you be willing to go somewhere if you were called to this? And I was like, yeah, I'd go to these places. And then he was like, what about these places? And I was like, no, that's too dangerous. We can't go there. And so in this hypothetical scenario, he was like, well, if you believe that God has called you to something, wouldn't you believe that he would take care of our kids and that he would have them cared for? And I had this, like, physical reaction. It was like mama bear, like, how dare you say that? Like, you know, but I was sitting there thinking in this very hypothetical situation, my hypothetical response was that, do I actually believe this? No. My belief system, what I was saying, wasn't lining up with my hypothetical convictions. But yeah, there's something to that. I was thinking about Abraham and Isaac, and I'm like, what would I have done in that scenario? And in that moment, I don't think I would have been willing to give up my child. And so this is something that we need to go back to and evaluate and say, you know, is what we're saying we believe lining up with the way we are living and our actions? So yes, this is the way the family should look, but look at that cute little Gerber baby contest winner, not my child. Look at that though. There's this moment when you become a parent And the first time you hold your child, like, I remember just looking at my daughter, and the only thing I could think of to do was just weep, because I was so happy, and I'd never experienced this type of love before, and I was just blown away that God had given me this child. And, like, you know, we were driving home from the hospital going 40 miles per hour because we were so scared that we were going to hurt this beautiful child that we'd been given. But it's easy, you know, in these moments when you are filled with this much love, to put that child at the center of your life, where their needs and their priorities matter more than anything else. Or what about this one? That poor child. It was on the internet, so I don't feel bad about putting it up. I don't know whose kid it is. But yeah, or maybe this becomes the center, where we are constantly focused and centered on trying to manage our children's moods, trying to keep that meltdown from happening, trying to be able to go out in public and not have a total breakdown. That can become our focus. Or this, that child apparently graduated college at 13, according to the internet. But maybe this becomes our focus, where we're like, you know what? I want my child to have a good life. I want them to have a rewarding, fulfilling career, success, you know? And so this, their education, their grade cards, you know, this becomes our focus. We have to focus on school and buckle down. Or this, I don't play sports, but he looks like he knows how to play soccer. And maybe that becomes it, where, you know, we see our child's good at this sport. They really care about it. This is going to become what I'm focused on. So we can fall into child-centered parenting. And I have some ways that I think that this can play out in our lives. I want to make a qualification right here from the start. I am not saying that if you do any of these things, you automatically are a child-centered parent. Because it's really about your attitude behind actions, right? It's not about the behavior itself, but rather, why are we doing the things that we're doing? And so you might see this list I'm going to talk through, and you might say, yes, I do some of these things, but it's because of these reasons, and I don't feel like that is child-centered. That's fine. That is between you and God and your spouse, and that, you know, that's not what I'm trying to do. But here are things that, ways that I have seen it creep up in my own life, and so I think they're just good things to think through. But I think one way it can creep up is in our conversations. For example, we've all had this, right, where you have a hangout planned with a friend, and you're like, man, I've prayed about this person. I want to ask them these questions. I have this very specific thing I want to bring up with them. And then you sit down to talk. You begin the conversation. And then all of a sudden, your child, mom, 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 mom. And they have a million questions, right? They want to tell you their deepest thoughts in that moment, and they want to ask you about the meaning of life and existence, and, like, they have these deep, profound thoughts right when you have a goal and a direction that you're headed in your conversation. So how do you handle that? Well, I know for me, a lot of times I'm like, I want my child to feel heard. I want them to feel understood. And so it's easy to want to stop right there and listen. But what does that communicate to our child? Does it communicate that their thoughts, their ideas, their questions are more important than anyone else and what they have to say? Couldn't we also still communicate to our child that they are valued and they are understood and they are heard by saying, hey, I do want to hear you, but right now we're talking and you're going to have to wait your turn. So why don't you go occupy yourself and I will come and hear all those questions and hear all of your thoughts in a little bit. That could be a way this plays out. Or what about talking about our children? You know, I think that that is completely okay, and that is part of God-centered parenting, to talk about our kids, because it is a big part of our lives, right? We are parents. It is a big part of the things that impact us in our day-to-day life. And so we should talk about that. That is God-centered, to want to share with other people what we're struggling with, what we're going through. But is it the only thing that we talk about? Is it the only way that we see ourselves? Because at the end of the day, yes, you are a parent. Yes, you are a mother, a father, but you are more than that. You are a spouse. You are a friend. You are a follower of God. You are his workman. You know, you are a learner. You have hobbies. There is a lot to you beyond being a parent. And so, yes, we should talk about our kids, but is it dominating our conversations? Is it the only thing that we're thinking about? I think that it can also creep up in our home life. For example, mealtimes. You know, are meals completely centered on what our kid wants? Or do we also acknowledge that there are two adults that also have tastes, interests, and things that they want to eat? I was watching this Instagram mom, and she was going on this rant of frustration about how she's cooking like 2 to 3 meals a night just to satisfy what her kids want. And she's like, oh, I put that in the wrong cup. Don't worry, let me fix that for you. And then she like basically yells at herself, and she's like, how do I have the audacity to spoil my child and then get mad when they act spoiled? But the point being, she was like, I've created my own chaos. Like, I've, you know, let them act this way. I think, too, this can come out in living spaces. Look at that picture. That looks like my house. It's not my house, but it looks like it. I'm not saying that if your house is messy, this means you are a child-centered parent. I think there is a lot of reasons we could have a messy house. For example, you could have said, you know what? I have this hangout planned. I am going to spend time with another person because that's what's important, and I'm not going to worry about my house being messy. I think that is a great reason to have a messy house. Or maybe you were working on a teaching and trying to make a PowerPoint, and you're a Gen Xer who hates technology, and it was making you panic. This is me. And so you spent a lot of time doing that, and so your house is trashed right now. I feel like I'm happy with that. I feel totally fine about my decision. But, you know, yes, there are good reasons why our house could be messy. But I think we have to be honest, toys can overtake us, right? Where we're given them as gifts, we buy them, there's a good garage sale, how do you pass that up? You know, we start to accumulate toys and they spill out to every room of our house and they just take over. There's this one author, I didn't read this whole book, but I read the first couple chapters of it. And she talks about, basically she's a doctor and she's going through like, you know, seeing like, man, I'm struggling in parenting, and she goes to this Maya culture and sees like, man, when I go over here, the family dynamic is way different. Everyone's helpful. They have a good relationship. What's different? So she decides to study that. But she says here in this section, she's talking about this, basically like, I feel like I have the need to have all of these things for my child. You know, they need the next sensory bin that I saw on Pinterest. I need to make this next activity, or they're not going to be hitting the milestones they need to hit to become developed in the way they're supposed to be by 2 years old. Or I need those magnet tiles. I need those Legos. I need my child to have these things, or they're not going to be ready for school. You know, I need those loud toys that go off and sing in multiple languages and tell them their ABCs, or how are they going to be ready for kindergarten? You know, we feel like, you know, they're in need, and it starts to take over our house. But she says here, the answer, why do we have all these toys? The answer has more to do with the Industrial Revolution and the burgeoning consumerism than it does with cognitive science or child development. She makes the case there's actually no studies that say they need these things. It has not been proven. Back in the early 1800s, all kids in the U.S. pretty much played in the same way. No matter if they were rich, poor, or somewhere in between, they didn't have toys in their homes. Instead, they did what kids have done for 200,000 years. They created their own toys with objects they found around the house or outside. In the mid-1800s, a new idea in psychology emerged and collided with the Industrial Revolution, and Western children have never played the same way again. Parenting experts began advocating for the use of blocks in the school and at home to teach values of order as well as building skills, and for the use of board games to enhance powers of planning and order. A few decades later, the Industrial Revolution ushered in countless new ways to produce toys, dolls, puzzles, and books in bulk. Never before were children's trinkets cheaper to produce or more appealing to children. Toys were more colorful, dolls were more lifelike, and both were more widely advertised to eager parents who had more disposable income in their pockets. You know, I'm not saying that toys are bad. I have tons of toys. If you want toys, I can give you toys. I'm always purging. But the point is, do we feel like our children need this? That this is so important for their development, it comes above everything else. Here's this picture from my child's book, and I just feel like this is just the epitome of of childhood. You know, they're in a room full of toys and it's like, there's nothing to do. You know, they're just always bored. They're, you know, when there's too much stuff, there's nothing to do. Less is sometimes better. So yes, it can creep up in our homes that way, but I think also child-centered parenting can creep up in our time. All of the schedules, just say that. Parenting comes with a lot of schedules. I am not a scheduled person, but when I became a parent, all of a sudden there was a million schedules put on my plate, right? You have feeding schedules. You know, pediatricians will tell you babies need to eat so many times a day and at such an interval. You know, you have this new schedule. What about sleep schedules, nap schedules, play group schedules? And then they get older and there's more schedules, like school schedules, and then you're on like three freaking carpool schedules. And then on top of that, you've got sports schedules and extracurriculars. And then if you have more than one kid, multiply that by however many kids you have. You have all of those schedules. That is making me anxious, just like talking about all of these schedules. Yeah, but they can become to feel like, I want to specifically talk about the feeding and sleep schedule, because I think that is one of the biggest deals for new parents. Because let's be real, your sanity is kind of dependent on it. Like, you feel like, man, yes, this is the center of my life right now because I'm going to go crazy if I'm not concerned about this. But where did those schedules come from? Because oftentimes, you know, our kids will be giving us a cue, but maybe, you know, we're reading different things and we're like, you know, this book says that I need to do all of this. I need to feed my kid every 2 hours. I need to do X, Y, Z, or they're not going to develop the way that they should, or they need to sleep at this very specific regimen, or they're not going to be okay. Well, yet again, this book, the mom that she is quoting here is a journalist, and this mom decided to go through all of the parenting literature over the centuries. And so she undertook a massive project. She read and reviewed more than 650 parenting books and manuals dating all the way back to the mid-1700s. Around this time, experts began writing manuals for intelligent parents, and the field of pediatrics began to emerge as a distinct discipline. The book's conclusion is a whopper. Much of the parenting advice out there today isn't based on scientific or medical studies or even traditional knowledge passed down from grandmas to moms for centuries. Instead, a big chunk of it comes from century-old pamphlets, often written by male doctors intended for foundling hospitals, where nurses cared for dozens, even hundreds, of abandoned babies all at once. You know, for example, she talks about the specific two-hour feeding window was actually created by a doctor in the 1700s because he was trying to help these nurses figure out how to feed hundreds of babies at this hospital. And so he's like, you need a strict regimen. Yet again, I think that lined up for my kids a lot. They were hungry every 2 hours, but there's cues that they give. You can follow those. The point is, we can oftentimes turn to these things that we read and hear and think, this is the most important thing for my child's happiness. This book, Free Range Kids, she's humorous, so she's being a little snarky here. But she says, free yourself from advice overload by remembering that we got to this point in human history without the benefit of child-rearing manuals, pregnancy diet books, or potty training treatises. If you seek parenting advice, first try asking an older parent you admire. She'll be thrilled, and her advice won't last 378 pages. I find it humorous because she did write a parenting book, and I'm like, well, I'm reading it, so should I not? But I think it's a great point that I think we're first more inclined to go to the books, to do the research, look at what the experts say. But it's like we have so many resources all around us, and our kids are so different. So yes, I think that is a way it can become a focus in our life. But also, like I said, it's not just when they're babies. It gets more and more as they get older. All of the activities. And there's this feeling, at least for me as a mom, now that my kids have gotten older, where I'm like, man, I want them to have all these hangouts with their friends. So, you know, they're not just going to school and that's it. Or I want them to be well-rounded. So I want them to do these different sports or these, you know, these different things. And so we can fill up their schedules with all of these different activities. But sometimes it's good to just not have anything to do. Sometimes it's nice to have some peace. This book, Comfort Crisis, talks about the importance of boredom, that actually when we deprive our children of boredom, we are cutting back their creativity. He says, our brains essentially have two modes, focused and unfocused. Focus mode is mind at attention. It's on when we're processing outside information, completing a task, checking our cell phone, watching TV, listening to a podcast, having a conversation, playing with toys, or anything else that would require us to attend the outside world. Unfocused mode occurs when we're not paying attention. It's inward mind wandering, a rest state that restores and rebuilds the resources needed to work better and more efficiently in the focused state. Time in unfocused mode is critical to get stuff done, tap into creativity, process complicated information, and more. Sorry, I quoted the book. He says that. Our collective lack of boredom may be causing us to reach near crisis levels of mental fatigue. And then he goes on to talk about even like creativity tests and how there's been a decline in recent years from the 50s to now in how creative people are. So it's okay for your kids to not have a million things on their plate. Another way that this can creep up is when we start to prioritize our children's schedules over everything else. And I think this is the big deal, where the things that we feel like our child needs, the things that we have planned and scheduled for them, become more important than what God says that we need and what He wants us to do in our lives. It's easy to fall into that, where it's like, you know what? Yes, I want to go to Bible study tonight, but my kid's sleeping earlier now, so I'm not going to be able to make it. So we're going to either rotate or skip or whatever. You know, that could be a way that this plays out. Or maybe, you know, your kids get older and it's like, well, I don't want my kid to be tired for school. So sorry, we're going to peace out really early because my kid needs to go to bed so that they can be engaged at school and ready to focus. Or hey, yes, I would go do these things, make new friends, hang out with people, all of these things. But yeah, my kid just has all of these things that I need to focus on. But at the end of the day, what we're prioritizing is going to be communicated to our children. The way that we spend our time is going to influence them. It's easy to have this feeling of, you know what, life's just hard right now. Later on, when I'm in a different phase of life, it'll be easier, and I'll be able to do all those things again. I'll be able to go back and have consistent fellowship time. I'll be able to go back and have those consistent hangouts with my friends, or to go out and make new friends and share the gospel and all of these things. It'll just have to be another phase of life, though, because this one's too hard. Well, the truth is, every phase of life is hard. I was at a retreat with some other leaders in my sphere, and we were talking about this. This is a couple years ago. But this idea of, like, is it too much to call people to something when life's so hard? Like, is there a case for, like, you know, it's just too much right now? And this older woman, I can't remember her name now. Sherry would probably know. But she leads a Bible study in a nursing home. So she's, like, in her 80s. And she was there, and she was like, you know, every stage of life is hard, though. She's like, I've been through it all. And it was hard having kids. It was hard being middle-aged. And then she's like, you know what? I didn't even want to come here. She's like, but I let them pick me up and put me in that car and drive me here, and I'm happy I did. But, like, she's making the case of, like, you know, it never gets easier. There's always going to be something. It's always going to feel busy. And let's not just say, I'm going to wait till it gets easier. Howard Hendricks says, there's no conflict of duty in Christian experience. Your call to the ministry is not in conflict with your call to be a father, a husband, a mother, a wife. And I have discovered that personal failure does not arise from overwork. It arises from ambiguity of mission, not really knowing what are my objectives, what do I want, what price am I willing to pay. It's losing sight of what's at the center, right? That God is at the center, and He's not going to call you to too much, and He will give you the power to do it all. So I think there's some dangers that arise in self-centered parenting. I'm sure we can see this. It's going to be self-centeredness, right? If we are making our child feel like they are the center of our universe, that their thoughts, their ideas matter more than anyone else, that their schedule is more important than our schedule, that they are the biggest influence in our home, it's going to lead to self-centeredness. And that can play out in their spiritual life as well. Maybe they're able to get it together and go be a functioning adult. They will. But how are they going to view their relationship with God? You know, they're always going to be temperature checking. How am I feeling about my relationship with God right now? Where am I at? What's going through my head? What am I struggling with? And get so absorbed in their own selves that they forget and lose sight of the people around them. How am I serving the people around me? Dr. Leonard Sachs, in his book, The Collapse in Parenting, he talks about this, that ultimately, one of the dangers of this is that when we are putting our child at the center, we are telling them that they are actually the authority, that they are the authority of our family, and they know better, and their ideas are best. And he talks about how, in the end, they're going to resort then to looking to their friends for approval instead of parents, because clearly we've devalued ourselves. But he has some other things I don't know if I fully agree with, so I'm going to stop there. But yeah, it can lead to putting our kids in a place of authority. So how then do we hold the center? I think I've made this case, but just to say it again, we need to show our children what God values. Not just say it, but we need to show with our actions what we value. Are we showing our children that fellowship with other people is important? Are we showing our children that God comes first in our lives? And secondly, we need to teach our children what God values. So like I said, in my family, we're doing, we've done a couple different studies. I read Heaven for Kids with my daughter, and she absolutely loved that one. That was a great way to get her thinking and understanding the things that God says is true and just thinking about heaven. Right now, we're doing this 24 Family Ways, which I think has been helpful. They have, like, here's some different qualities or characteristics of a good family, and, like, you know, here's the topic. Like, Jesus is the authority in our family. And then they have verses for every day that you can read, and then discussion questions. That's been really helpful for us. And my kids have enjoyed it. We have, like, little journals for them, and we pick specific discussion questions for each kid, and then we talk about it and pray together. That's a way we can do that. But also, we want to teach God's virtues to our children. In this book, he cites The Collapse of Parenting. He cites, you know, how when we're teaching cognitive achievement to our children, when we're trying to help our kids be hard workers, we don't want to tell them they're smart. We don't want to say you're smart or not smart. We don't want to make an identity statement, but rather, you know, focus on the behavior. You're trying hard, not trying hard. But he says when it comes to teaching virtues, it's a little bit different. Teaching virtues may be different. Should I say to my daughter, that was a very kind thing you did? Or should I say, you are a very kind person? Does it make a difference? You know, if we apply that rule from that Stanford professor, it would say that we're supposed to focus on the behavior, right? But there is now good evidence that when it comes to teaching virtue, this approach is precisely the wrong way. When it comes to teaching virtue, identity seems to work better than behavior. You are a very kind person works better than that was a very kind thing you did. In one study, students were less likely to cheat when they were told that the researchers were studying the prevalence of cheaters. That's an identity statement. The proportion of students who cheated more than doubled when researchers instead said that they were studying the prevalence of cheating, which is a behavior. Likewise, researchers have recently found that young children are more likely to help with a project if they are encouraged to be a helper, which is an identity, rather than merely asked to help. In reality, behavior influences identity and eventually becomes identity. I thought this was interesting. I had never heard this before, and I just read this book, and I was like, man, I'm going to start trying to do this. But, like, pointing out, the identity statements when it comes to these virtues. I was subbing at Calumet recently and was listening to the third grade teacher, Mr. Lesline, and I heard him do this with a student, and I was like, man, that was a great way. But this kid came up and was like, Mr. Lesline, did you see this thing that I did? And he was like, yeah, I love how God has made you such a caring person. And he made it an identity statement, and that kid's face just lit up. So if we want to communicate these things to our kids, I think through this. I'm not saying go tell your kid you're a cheater, you're a fool. I have told my kids they're acting like a fool before, but, you know, maybe don't do that. I'm not saying to precisely use the negatives, but I think encouraging these positive ones, that could be really effective. So yes, we want to teach our children what God values. And then also we want to teach humility. So our culture gets really focused on self-esteem, right? Like if you want your kids to be mentally and emotionally healthy, they need to have good self-esteem. Well, Leonard Sachs says instead it should actually be humility. The right kind of humility helps you to recognize your shortcomings, to be better prepared, to understand the risks, and to take those risks courageously when necessary. The antidote to the culture of bloated self-esteem is the culture of humility. If I am in the culture of humility, then I rejoice at the success of others, and I am happy with my portion. So how do we teach humility to our kids? A big way is through doing chores. He talks about this in his book, that if you want your kids to grow in humility, not chores where you pay them, like not just like, hey, you're earning an income here, but like you are a part of this family and this is your role, that you have something to contribute to this family. You are not a taker here. You are a part of it. And that's actually really encouraging for them. It builds their confidence, but it's also teaching them where they fit in the family. So yes, teach humility to your kids, but I think also a way that we can hold the center is enjoy your kids. I think that is a big one, that when you are having time with your kids, please be there with them. Don't be on your screen. Don't be distracted thinking about the next conversation you have to have or the teaching you have to do or, you know, whatever it may be. Be with your kids. Enjoy the time that you have with them because it is short. Yes, it is you know, a huge chunk of human life spent in childhood and adolescence, but it flies by. And ultimately, your children will see this. I remember having this fear of like, man, I feel so distracted all the time. Like, is my daughter going to feel neglected? Are my kids going to feel neglected? Because I feel like I'm always doing these other things. But I was looking at my daughter this past week. We were on a home church beach trip, and I saw her. You know, she could have been really upset. She was sad that none of her friends were there. It was all little kids. And she, you know, was like, who am I going to play with? But she came to that trip, and she just served people. She was like, how can I help the moms? Let me babysit all these kids. Let me distract them. And just watching her, I was like, you know what? She was willing to lay aside what she felt she needed and just serve the home church in that way. And I'm like, okay, yes, I have messed up as a parent in a lot of ways, and I'm sure my daughter is going to have a lot of thoughts about me down the road. But I felt like that was a success. That was communicated to her, that in the end, serving other people was more important than what she felt she needed. So, yeah, we'll stop there. I have some pictures of books. Some of them I talked about. I put a couple more Leonard Sachs books there because I love them. So feel free to look those up if you want. All right, why don't we pray? Well, God, just thank you for the gift of parenting. Thank you that you have entrusted us with our children. And thank you, Lord, that you love them more than we could ever understand and more than we ever could. So just pray, Lord, that as we consider these things, we can remember that you have a purpose for us and that you care deeply for our family and have our best interests at heart. So pray that we can keep you at the center there. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.